into Griffin and Unicorn. Ned left his horse with Jax and shouldered his way inside. The slim young serving girl took quick note of Ned's badge and the sigil on his doublet, and the master came hurrying out, all smiles and bows.
"Wine for the king's hand," he told the girl, gesturing Ned to a couch. "I am Topo Mutt, my lord. Please, please, put yourself at ease."
He wore a black velvet coat with hammers embroidered on the sleeves and silver thread. Around his neck was a heavy silver chain and a sapphire as large as a pigeon's egg.
"If you are in need of new arms for the hands tourney, you've come to the right shop."
Ned did not bother to correct him.
"My work is costly, and I make no apologies for that, my lord," he said as he filled two matching silver goblets. "You will not find craftsmanship equal to mine anywhere in the Seven Kingdoms, I promise you. Visit every forge in King's Landing, if you like, and compare for yourself. Any village smith can hammer out a shirt of mail. My work is art."
Ned sipped his wine and let the man go on. "The Knight of Flowers bought all his armour here," Tubbo boasted, "and many high lords, the ones who knew fine steel, and even Lord Renly, the king's own brother. Perhaps the hand had seen Lord Renly's new armour, the green plate with the golden antlers. No other armour in the city could get that deeper green. He knew the secret of putting colour in the steel itself. Paint and enamel were the crutches of a journeyman. Or mayhaps the hand wanted a blade. Tubho had learned to work Valyrian steel at the forges of Kuhor as a boy. Only a man who knew the spells could take old weapons and forge them anew."
"The direwolf was a sigil of our stock, is it not? I could fashion a direwolf helm so real the children will run from you in the street," he vowed.
Ned smiled. "Did you make a falcon helm for Lord Aaron?" Topho Mutt paused a long moment and set aside the wine.
"The hand did call upon me with Lord Stannis, the king's brother. I regret to say they did not honour me with their patronage."
Ned looked at the man evenly, saying nothing, waiting. He had found over the years that silence sometimes yielded more than questions, and so it was this time.
"They asked to see the boy," the armourer said, "so I took them back to the forge."
"The boy?" Ned echoed. He had no notion who the boy might be. "I should like to see the boy as well." Topo Mutt gave him a cool, careful look.
"As you wish, my lord," he said, with no trace of his former friendliness.
He led Ned out of a rear door and across a narrow yard back to the cavernous stone barn where the work was done. When the armourer opened the door, the blast of hot air that came through made Ned feel as though he was walking into a dragon's mouth. Inside, a forge blazed in each corner and the air stank of smoke and sulphur. Journeymen armourers glanced up from their hammers and tongs just long enough to wipe the sweat from their brows, while bare-chested apprentice boys worked the bellows. The master called over a tall lad, about Rob's age, his arms and chest corded with muscle.
"This is Lord Stark, the new hand of the king," he told him as the boy looked at Ned through sullen blue eyes and pushed back sweat-soaked hair with his fingers. Thick hair, shaggy and unkempt, and black as ink. The shadow of a new beard darkened his jaw.
"This is Gendry, strong for his age, and he works hard. Show the hand that helmet you made, lad."
Almost shyly, the boy led them to his bench, and a steel helm shaped like a bull's head with two great curving horns. Ned turned the helm over in his hands. It was raw steel, unpolished, but expertly shaped. "This is fine work. I would be pleased if you would let me buy it." The boy snatched it out of his hands.
"It's not for sale."
Topo Mutt looked horror-struck.
"Boy, this is the king's hand. If his lordship wants this helm, make him a gift of it. He honours you by asking.
I made it for me, the boy said stubbornly.
100 pardons, my lord, his master said hurriedly to Ned. The boy is crude, as new steel, and like new steel would profit from some beating. That helm is journeyman's work at best. Forgive him, and I will promise I will craft you a helm like none you have ever seen.
He has done nothing that requires my forgiveness. Gendry, when Lord Arryn came to see you, what did you talk about?
He asked me questions, is all, my lord.
What sort of questions?
The boy shrugged. How was I, and was I well treated, and if I liked the work, and stuff about my mother, who she was, and what she looked like, and all.
What did you tell him? Ned asked.
The boy shoved a fresh fall of black hair off his forehead. She died when I was little. She had yellow hair, and sometimes she used to sing to me, I remember. She worked in an alehouse.
Did Lord Stannis question you as well?
The bald one? No, not him. He never said no word, just glared at me, like I was some raper who'd done for his daughter. Mind your filthy tongue, the master said. This is the king's own hand.
The boy lowered his eyes.
A smart boy, eh? But stubborn. That helm. The others called him bull-headed, so he threw it in their teeth.
Ned touched the boy's head, fingering the thick black hair. Look at me, Gendry. The apprentice lifted his face. Ned studied the shape of his jaw, the eyes like blue ice.
Yes, he thought. I see it.
Go back to your work, lad. I am sorry to have bothered you. He walked back to the house with the master. Who paid the boy's apprentice fee? He asked lightly.
Mott looked fretful. You saw the boy, such a strong boy. Those hands of his, those hands were made for hammers. He had such promise. I took him on without a fee.
The truth now, Ned said. The streets are full of strong boys. The day you take on an apprentice without a fee will be the day the wall comes down. Who paid for him?
Lord, the master said reluctantly. He gave no name, and wore no sigil on his coat. He paid in gold, twice the customary sum, and he said he was paying once for the boy and once for my silence.
Describe him.
He was stout, round of shoulder, not so tall as you. Brown beard, but there was a bit of red in it elsewhere. He wore a rich cloak, that I do remember, heavy purple velvet worked with silver threads, but the hood shadowed his face, and I never did see him clear.
He hesitated a moment.
My lord, I want no trouble.
None of us wants trouble, but I fear these are troubled times, Master Mott, Ned said. You know who the boy is.
I'm only an armourer, my lord. I know what I'm told.
You know who the boy is, Ned repeated patiently. That is not a question.
The boy is my apprentice, the master said.
He looked Ned in the eye, stubborn as old iron.
Who he was before he came to me, that's none of my concern.
Ned nodded. He decided that he liked Tubhomut, master armourer. If the day ever comes when Gendry would rather wield a sword than forge one, send him to me. He has the look of a warrior. Until then, you have my thanks, Master Mott, and my promise. Should I ever want a helm to frighten children, this will be the first place I visit. His guard was waiting outside with the horses. Did you find anything, my lord? Jax asked as Ned mounted up.
I did, Ned told him, wondering.
What had John Arryn wanted with a king's bastard? And why was it worth his life?
Jamie. I had hoped that by now you would have grown tired of that wretched beard. All that hair makes you look like Robert. His sister had put aside her mourning for a jade-green gown with sleeves of silver mirish lace. An emerald the size of a pigeon's egg hung on a golden chain about her neck. Robert's beard was black, mine is gold.
Gold? Or silver?
Circe plucked a hair from beneath his chin and held it up. It was grey. All the colour is draining out of you, brother. You've become a ghost of what you were, a pale, crippled thing, and so bloodless, always in white. She flicked the hair away. I prefer you garbed in crimson and gold. I prefer you dappled in sunlight with water beading on your naked skin. He wanted to kiss her, carry her to her bedchamber, throw her on the bed. She's been fucking Lancel and Osmond, Kettleblack and Moonboy. I will make a bargain with you. Relieve me of this duty, and my razor is yours to command. Her mouth tightened. She had been drinking hot spiced wine and smelled of nutmeg. You presume to dicker with me. Need I remind you, you are sworn to obey. I am sworn to protect the king. My place is at his side. Your place is wherever he sends you. Tommen puts his seal on every paper that you put in front of him. This is your doing, and it's folly. Why name Davin your warden of the West if you have no faith in him? Circe took a seat beneath the window. Behind her, Jaime could see the blackened ruin of the Tower of the Hand. Why so reluctant, sir? Did you lose your courage with your hand? I swore an oath to Lady Stark, never again to take up arms against the Starks or Tullys. A drunken promise made with a sword at your throat. How can I defend Tommen if I am not with him? By defeating his enemies. Father always said that a swift sword stroke is a better defense than any shield. Admittedly, most sword strokes require a hand. Still, even a crippled lion may inspire fear. I want Riverrun. I want Brynden Tully chained or dead, and someone needs to set Harrenhal to rights. We have urgent need of Willis Manderley, assuming he is still alive and captive, but the garrison has not replied to any of our ravens. Those are Gregor's men at Harrenhal, Jaime reminded her. The mountain liked them cruel and stupid. Most like they ate your ravens, messages and all. That's why I'm sending you. They may eat you as well, brave brother, but I trust you'll give them indigestion. Circe smoothed her skirt. I want Sir Osmond to command the King's Guard in your absence. She's been fucking Lancel and Osmond, Kettleblack and Moonboy for all I know. That's not your choice. If I must go, Sir Loras will command here in my stead. Is that a jape? You know how I feel about Sir Loras. If you had not sent Balon's swan to Dorne, I need him there. These Dornish men cannot be trusted. That red snake championed Tyrion. Have you forgotten that? I will not leave my daughter to their mercy, and I will not have Loras Tyrell commanding the King's Guard. Sir Loras is thrice the man Sir Osmond is. Your notions of manhood have changed somewhat, brother. Jaime felt his anger rising. True, Loras does not leer at your teats the way Sir Osmond does, but I hardly think... Think about this! Circe slapped his face. Jaime made no attempt to block the blow. I see I need a thicker beard to cushion me against my queen's caresses. He wanted to rip her gown off and turn her blows to kisses. He'd done it before, back when he had two good hands. The queen's eyes were green ice. You had best go, sir. Lancel, Osmond, Kettleblack, and Moonboy. Are you deaf as well as maimed? You'll find the door behind you, sir. As you command. Jaime turned on his heel and left her. Somewhere the gods were laughing. Circe had never taken kindly to being balked. He knew that. Softer words might have swayed her. Yet of late, the very sight of her made him angry. Part of him would be glad to put King's Landing behind him. He had no taste for the company of the lickspittles and fools who surrounded Circe. The smallest council, they were calling them in Fleabottom, according to Adam Marbrand. And Qyburn, he might have saved Jaime's life, but he was still a bloody mama. Qyburn stinks of secrets, he warned Circe. That only made her laugh. We all have secrets, brother,
she replied. "She's been fucking Lancel and Osmond, Kettle Black and Moonboy, for all I know." 40 knights and as many esquires awaited him outside the Red Keep stables. Half were Westermen sworn to House Lannister, the others recent foes turned doubtful friends. Sir Dermot of the Rainwood would carry Tommen's standard, Red Ronnet Connington, the white banner of the Kingsguard. A page, a piper, and a Peckledon would share the honour of squiring for the Lord Commander. "Keep your friends at your back, and foes where you can see them," Sumner Craycall had once counselled him. Or had that been father? His palfrey was a blood bay, his destrier a magnificent grey stallion. It had been long years since Jamie had named any of his horses. He had seen too many die in battle, and that was harder when you named them. But when the Piper Boy started calling them Honour and Glory, he laughed and let the name stand. Glory wore trappings of Lannister crimson. Honour was barded in Kingsguard white. Josmin Peckledon held the palfrey's reins as Sir Jamie mounted. The squire was skinny as a spear, with long arms and legs, greasy mouse-brown hair and cheeks, soft with peach fuzz. His cloak was Lannister crimson, but his surcoat showed the 10 purple mullets of his own house arrayed upon a yellow field. "My lord," the lad asked, "will you be wanting your new hand?" "Wear it, Jamie," urged Sir Kennis of Case. "Wave at the small folk and give them a tale to tell their children." "I think not." Jamie would not show the crowds a golden lie. Let them see the stump. Let them see the cripple. "But feel free to make up for my lack, Sir Kennos. Wave with both hands and waggle your feet if it please you." He gathered the reins in his left hand and wheeled his horse around. "Payne," he called as the rest were forming up, "you'll ride beside me." Sir Ilyn Payne made his way to Jamie's side, looking like the beggar at the ball. His ringmail was old and rusted, worn over a stained jack of boiled leather. Neither the man nor his mount showed any heraldry. His shield was so hacked and battered it was hard to say what colour paint might once have covered it. With his grim face and deep-sunk hollow eyes, Sir Ilyn might have passed for death himself, as he had for years. No longer, though. Sir Ilyn had been half of Jamie's price for swallowing his boy king's command like a good little commander. The other half had been Sir Adam Marbrand. "I need them," he had told his sister, and Circe had not put up a fight. Most like she's pleased to rid herself of them. Sir Adam was a boyhood friend of Jamie's, and the silent headsman had belonged to their father, if he belonged to anyone. Payne had been the captain of the Hand's Guard when he had been heard boasting that it was Lord Tywin who ruled the Seven Kingdoms and told King Aerys what to do. Aerys Targaryen took his tongue for that. "Open the gates," said Jamie. And Strongbore, in his booming voice, called out, "Open the gates!" When Mace Tyrell had marched out through the mud gate to the sound of drums and fiddles, thousands lined the streets to cheer him off. Little boys had joined the march, striding along beside the Tyrell soldiers with heads held high and legs pumping, whilst their sisters threw down kisses from the windows. Not so today. A few whores called out invitations as they passed, and a meat pie man cried his wares. In Cobbler Square, two threadbare sparrows were haranguing several hundred small folk, crying doom upon the heads of godless men and demon worshippers. The crowd parted for the column. Sparrows and cobblers alike looked on with dull eyes. "They like the smell of roses, but have no love for lions," Jamie observed. "My sister would be wise to take note of that." Sir Ilyn made no reply. The perfect companion for a long ride. I will enjoy his conversation. The greater part of his command awaited him beyond the city walls. Sir Adam Marbrand with his outriders, Sir Stephen Swift and the baggage train, the holy hundred of old Sir Bonifa the Good, Sarsfield's mounted archers, Maester Gullion with 4 cages full of ravens, 200 heavy horse under Sir Flemont Brax. Not a great host, all in all, fewer than 1,000 men in total. Numbers were the last thing needed at River Run. A Lannister army already invested the castle and an even larger force of Freys. The last bird they'd received suggested that the besiegers were having difficulty keeping themselves fed. Brynden Tully had scoured the land clean before retiring behind his walls. Not that it required much scouring. From what Jamie had seen of the Riverlands, scarce a field remained unburnt, a town unsacked, a maiden undespoiled. And now my sweet sister sends me to finish the work that Amory Lorch and Gregor Clegane began. It left a bitter taste in his mouth. This near to King's Landing, the King's Road was as safe as any road could be in such times, yet Jamie sent Marbrand and his outriders ahead to scout. "Rob Stark took me unawares in the Whispering Wood," he said. "That will never happen again." "You have my word on it." Marbrand seemed visibly relieved to be a horse again, wearing the smoke-grey cloak of his own house instead of the gold wool of the city watch. "If any foes should come within a dozen leagues, you will know of them beforehand." Jamie had given stern commands that no man was to depart the column without his leave. Elsewise, he knew he would have bored young lordlings racing through the fields, scattering livestock and trampling down the crops. There were still cows and sheep to be seen near the city, apples on the trees and berries in the brush, stands of barleycorn and oats and winter wheat, wains and ox carts on the road. Farther afield, things would not be so rosy. Riding at the front of the host with Sir Ilan, silent by his side, Jamie felt almost content. The sun was warm on his back, and the wind riffled through his hair like a woman's fingers. When little Lou Piper came galloping up with a helm full of blackberries, Jamie ate a handful and told the boy to share the rest with his fellow squires and Sir Ilan Payne. Payne seemed as comfortable in his silence as in his rusted ringmail and boiled leather. The clop of his gelding's hooves and the rattle of sword in scabbard whenever he shifted his seat were the only sounds he made. Though his pox-scarred face was grim and his eyes as cold as ice on a winter lake, Jamie sensed that he was glad he'd come. "I gave the man a choice," he reminded himself. "He could have refused me and remained King's Justice." Sir Ilan's appointment had been a wedding gift from Robert Baratheon to the father of his bride, a sinecure to compensate Payne for the tongue he'd lost in the service of House Lannister. He made a splendid headsman. He had never botched an execution and seldom required as much as a second stroke. And there was something about his silence that inspired terror. Seldom had a king's justice seemed so well fitted for his office. When Jamie decided to take him, he had sought out Sir Ilan's chambers at the end of Traitor's Walk. The upper floor of the squat half-round tower was divided into cells for prisoners who required some measure of comfort, captive knights or lordlings awaiting ransom or exchange. The entrance to the dungeons proper was at ground level, behind a door of hammered iron and a second of splintery grey wood. On the floors between were rooms set aside for the use of the chief jailer, the Lord Confessor, and the King's Justice. The Justice was a headsman, but by tradition, he also had charge of the dungeons and the men who kept them. And for that task, Sir Ilan Payne was singularly ill-suited. As he could neither read nor write nor speak, Sir Ilan had left the running of the dungeons to his underlings, such as they were. The realm had not had a Lord Confessor since the second Darion, however, and the last chief jailer had been a cloth merchant who purchased the office from Littlefinger during Robert's reign. No doubt he'd had good profit from it for a few years until he made the error of conspiring with some other rich fools to give the Iron Throne to Stannis. They called themselves Antler Men, so Joff had nailed antlers to their heads before flinging them over the city walls. So it had been left to Renifer Longwaters, the head under-jailer with the twisted back, who claimed a tedious length to have a drop of dragon in him, to unlock the dungeon doors for Jaime and conduct him up the narrow steps inside the walls to the place where Ilan Payne had lived for 15 years. The chamber stank of rotted food, and the rushes were crawling with vermin. As Jamie entered, he almost trod upon a rat. Payne's great sword rested on a trestle table beside a whetstone and a greasy oilcloth. The steel was immaculate, the edge glimmering blue in the pale light, but elsewhere piles of soiled clothing were strewn about the floors, and the bits of mail and armour scattered here and there were red with rust. Jamie could not count the broken wine jars. "The man cares for naught but killing," he thought, as Sir Ilan emerged from a bedchamber that reeked of overflowing chamber pots.
"His Grace bids me win back his riverlands," Jamie told him. "I would have you with me, if you can bear to give up all of this." Silence was his answer and a long, unblinking stare. But just as he was about to turn and take his leave, Payne had given him a nod. "And here he rides." Jamie glanced at his companion. "Perhaps there is yet hope for the both of us." That night, they made camp beneath the hilltop castle of the Hayfords. As the sun went down, 100 tents sprouted beneath the hill along the banks of the stream that ran beside it. Jamie set the sentries himself. He did not expect trouble this close to the city, but his uncle Stafford had once thought himself safe on the Oxcross, too. It was best to take no chances. When the invitation came down from the castle for him to sup with Lady Hayford's castellan, Jamie took Sir Ilan with him, along with Sir Adam Marbrand, Sir Bonifer Hasty, Red Ronnet Connington, Strongbore, and a dozen other knights and lordlings. "I suppose I ought to wear the hand," he said to Peck before making his ascent. The lad fetched it straight away. The hand was wrought of gold, very lifelike, with inlaid nails of mother-of-pearl, its fingers and thumb half-closed so as to slip around a goblet's stem. "I cannot fight, but I can drink," Jamie reflected, as the lad was tightening the straps that bound it to his stump. "Men shall name you Golden Hand from this day forth, my lord," the armourer had assured him the first time he'd fitted it onto Jamie's wrist. "He was wrong. I shall be the King Slayer till I die." The Golden Hand was the occasion for much admiring comment over supper, at least until Jamie knocked over a goblet of wine. Then his temper got the best of him. "If you admire the bloody thing so much, lop off your own sword hand and you can have it," he told Flemont Brax. After that, there was no more talk about his hand, and he managed to drink some wine in peace. The lady of the castle was a Lannister by marriage, a plump toddler who had been wed to his cousin Tyrick before she was a year old. Lady Ermesend was duly trotted out for their approval, all trussed up in a little gown of cloth of gold, with the green, fretty and green pale wavy of House Hayford rendered in tiny beads of jade. But soon enough the girl began to squall, whereupon she was promptly whisked off to bed by her wet nurse. "Has there been no word of our Lord Tyrick?" her castellan asked, as a course of trout was served. "None." Tyrick Lannister had vanished during the riots in King's Landing, whilst Jamie himself was still captive at Riverrun. The boy would be 14 by now, assuming he was still alive. "I led a search myself at Lord Tywin's command," offered Adam Marbrand, as he boned his fish, "but I found no more than Bywater had before me. The boy was last seen a horse when the press of the mob broke the line of gold cloaks. Afterward, well, his palfrey was found, but not the rider. Most like they pulled him down and slew him. But if that's so, where is his body? The mob let the other corpses lie. Why not his?"
"He would be of more value alive," suggested Strongbore. "Any Lannister would bring a hefty ransom."
"No doubt," Marbrand agreed, "yet no ransom demand was ever made. The boy is simply gone." "The boy is dead." Jamie had drunk 3 cups of wine, and his golden hand seemed to be growing heavier and clumsier by the moment. "A hook would serve me just as well. If they realized whom they'd killed, no doubt they threw him in the river for fear of my father's wrath. They know the taste of that in King's Landing. Lord Tywin always paid his debts."
"Always," Strongbore agreed, and that was the end of that.
Yet afterward, alone in the tower room he had been offered for the night, Jamie found himself wondering. Tyrick had served King Robert as a squire side by side with Lancel. Knowledge could be more valuable than gold, more deadly than a dagger. It was Varys he thought of then, smiling and smelling of lavender. The eunuch had agents and informers all over the city. It would have been a simple matter for him to arrange to have Tyrick snatched during the confusion, provided he knew beforehand that the mob was like to riot. And Varys knew all, or so he would have us believe. Yet he gave Cersei no warning of that riot, nor did he ride down to the ships to see Myrcella off. He opened the shutters. The night was growing cold, and a horned moon rode the sky. His hand shone dully in its light. No good for throttling eunuchs, but heavy enough to smash that slimy smile into a fine red ruin. He wanted to hit someone. Jaime found Sir Ilan, honing his greatsword. "It's time," he told the man. The headsman rose and followed, his cracked leather boots scraping against the steep stone steps as they went down the stair. A small courtyard opened off the armory. Jaime found two shields there, two half-helms, and a pair of blunted tawny swords. He offered one to Payne and took the other in his left hand as he slid his right through the loops of the shield. His golden fingers were curved enough to hook, but could not grasp, so his hold upon the shield was loose. "You were a knight once, sir," Jaime said. "So was I. Let us see what we are now." Sir Ilan raised his blade in reply, and Jaime moved at once to the attack. Payne was as rusty as his ringmail, and not so strong as Brian, yet he met every cut with his own blade or interposed his shield. They danced beneath the horned moon as the blunted sword sang their steely song. The silent knight was content to let Jaime lead the dance for a while, but finally he began to answer stroke for stroke. Once he shifted to the attack, he caught Jaime on the thigh, on the shoulder, on the forearm. Thrice he made his head ring with cuts to the helm. One slash ripped the shield off his right arm and almost burst the straps that bound his golden hand to his stump. By the time they lowered their swords, he was bruised and battered, but the wine had burned away and his head was clear. "We will dance again," he promised Sir Ilan, "on the morrow and the morrow. Every day we'll dance until I am as good with my left hand as ever I was with the right." Sir Ilan opened his mouth and made a clacking sound. A laugh, Jaime realized. Something twisted in his gut. Come morning, none of the others was so bold as to make mention of his bruises. Not one of them had heard the sound of swordplay in the night, it would seem. Yet when they climbed back down to camp, little Lou Piper voiced the question the knights and lordlings dared not ask. Jaime grinned at him. "They have lusty wenches in House Hayford. These are love bites, lad." Another bright and blustery day was followed by a cloudy one, then 3 days of rain. Wind and water made no matter. The column kept its pace north along the King's Road, and each night Jaime found some private place to win himself more love bites. They fought inside a stable as a one-eyed mule looked on, and in the cellar of an inn amongst the casks of wine and ale. They fought in the blackened shell of a big stone barn, on a wooded island in a shallow stream, and in an open field as the rain pattered softly against their helms and shields. Jaime made excuses for his nightly forays, but he was not so foolish as to think that they were believed. Adam Marbrand knew what he was about, surely, and some of his other captains must have suspected. But no one spoke of it in his hearing, and since the only witness lacked a tongue, he need not fear anyone learning just how inept a swordsman the King Slayer had become. Soon the signs of war could be seen on every hand. Weeds and thorns and brushy trees grew high as a horse's head in fields where autumn wheat should be ripening. The King's Road was bereft of travellers, and wolves ruled the weary world from dusk till dawn. Most of the animals were wary enough to keep their distance, but one of Marbrand's outriders had his horse run off and killed when he dismounted for a piss. "No beast would be so bold," declared Sir Bonifa the Good, of the stern, sad face. "These are demons in the skins of wolves, sent to chastise us for our sins." "This must have been an uncommonly sinful horse," Jaime said, standing over what remained of the poor animal. He gave orders for the rest of the carcass to be cut apart and salted down. It might be they would need the meat. At a place called Sow's Horn, they found a tough old knight named Sir Roger Hogg squatting stubbornly in his tower house with 6 men-at-arms, 4 crossbowmen, and 10 peasants. Sir Roger was as big and bristly as his name, and Sir Kenos suggested that he might be some lost crake-hall, since their sigil was a brindled boar. Strongbore seemed to believe it, and spent an earnest hour questioning Sir Roger about his ancestors. Jaime was more interested in what Hogg had to say of wolves.
We had some trouble with a band of them White Star wolves, the old knight told him. They come round sniffing after you, my lord, but we saw them off and buried three down by the turnips. Before them there was a pack of bloody lions, begging your pardon. The one who led them had a manticore on his shield.
Sir Amory Lorch, Jamie offered. My lord father commanded him to harry the Riverlands.
Which we're no part of, Sir Roger Hogg said stoutly. My fealty's owed to House Hayford, and Lady Ermisande bends her little knee at King's Landing. Or will when she's old enough to walk. I told him that, but this Lorch wasn't much for listening. He slaughtered half my sheep and three good milk goats, and tried to roast me in my tower. My walls are solid stone and 8 feet thick, though, so after his fire burned out he rode off, bored. The wolves come later, the ones on four legs. They ate the sheep the manticore left me. I got a few good pelts in recompense, but fur don't fill your belly. What should we do, my lord?
Plant, said Jamie, and pray for one last harvest. It was not a hopeful answer, but it was the only one he had. The next day the column crossed the stream that formed the boundary between the lands that did fealty to King's Landing and those beholden to River Run. Maester Gullion consulted a map and announced that these hills were held by the Brothers Woad, a pair of landed knights sworn to Harrenhal. But their halls had been earth and timber, and only blackened beams remained of them. No woads appeared, nor any of their small folk, though some outlaws had taken shelter in a root cellar beneath the second brother's keep. One of them wore the ruins of a crimson cloak, but Jamie hanged him with the rest. It felt good. This was justice. Make a habit of it, Lannister, and one day men might call you Goldenhand after all. Goldenhand the Just. The world grew ever greyer as they drew near to Harrenhal. They rode beneath slate skies, beside waters that shone old and cold as a sheet of beaten steel. Jamie found himself wondering if Brienne might have passed this way before him, if she thought that Sansa Stark had made for River Run. Had they encountered other travellers, he might have stopped to ask if any of them had chanced to see a pretty maid with auburn hair, or a big, ugly one with a face that would curdle milk. But there was no one on the roads but wolves, and their howling held no answers. Across the pewter waters of the lake, the towers of Black Harren's Folly appeared at last, five twisted fingers of black, misshapen stone grasping for the sky. Though Littlefinger had been named the Lord of Harrenhal, he seemed in no great haste to occupy his new seat, so it had fallen to Jaime Lannister to sort out Harrenhal on his way to River Run. That it needed sorting out, he did not doubt. Gregor Clegane had wrested the immense, gloomy castle away from the Bloody Mummers before Circe recalled him to King's Landing. No doubt the Mountain's men were still rattling around inside like so many dried peas in a suit of plate, but they were not ideally suited to restore the king's peace to the Trident. The only peace Sir Gregor's lot had ever given anyone was the peace of the grave. Sir Adam's outriders had reported that the gates of Harrenhal were closed and barred. Jamie drew his men up before them and commanded Sir Kenos of Case to sound the horn of Herrick, black and twisted and banded in old gold. When three blasts had echoed off the walls, they heard the groan of iron hinges and the gates swung slowly open. So thick were the walls of Black Harren's Folly that Jamie passed beneath a dozen murder holes before emerging into sudden sunlight in the yard, where he'd bid farewell to the Bloody Mummers not so long ago. Weeds were sprouting from the hard-packed earth, and flies buzzed about the carcass of a horse. A handful of Sir Gregor's men emerged from the towers to watch him dismount. Hard-eyed, hard-mouthed men, the lot of them. They would have to be to ride beside the Mountain. About the best that could be said for Gregor's men was that they were not quite as vile and violent a bunch as the brave companions.
"Fuck me, Jaime Lannister," blurted one grey and grizzled man-at-arms. "It's the bleeding Kingslayer boys. Fuck me with a spear."
"Who might you be?" Jamie asked.
"Sir used to call me Shitmouth, if it please my lord.
He spit in his hands and wiped his cheeks with them, as if that would somehow make him more presentable. "Charming. Do you command here?"
"Me? Shit no, my lord. Bugger me with a bloody spear."
Shitmouth had enough crumbs in his beard to feed the garrison. Jamie had to laugh. The man took that for encouragement. "Bugger me with a bloody spear," he said again, and started laughing too. "You heard the man," Jamie said to Ilyn Payne. "Find a nice long spear and shove it up his arse." Sir Ilyn did not have a spear, but beardless John Betley was glad to toss him one. Shitmouth's drunken laughter stopped abruptly.
"You keep that bloody thing away from me."
"Make up your mind," said Jamie. "Who has the command here? Did Sir Gregor name a castellan?"
"Polliver," another man said. "Only the hound killed him, my lord. Him and the tickler both, and that Sarsfield boy."
The hound again.
"You know it was Sandor? You saw him?"
"Not us, my lord. That innkeep told us."
"It happened at the Crossroads Inn, my lord."
The speaker was a younger man with a mop of sandy hair. He wore the chain of coins that had once belonged to Vargo Hote, coins from 50 distant cities, silver and gold, copper and bronze, square coins and round coins, triangles and rings and bits of bone.
The innkeep swore the man had one side of his face all burned. His horse told the same tale. Sandor had some boy with him, a ragged peasant lad. They hacked Polly and the tickler to bloody bits and rode off down the Trident, we were told.
Did you send men after them?
Shitmouth frowned, as if the thought were painful.
No, my lord, fuck us all, we never did.
When a dog goes mad, you cut his throat.
Well, the man said, rubbing his mouth, I never much liked Polly, that shit, and the dog. He was Sir's brother, so.
We're bad, my lord,
broke in the man who wore the coins. But you'd need to be mad to face the hound. Jamie looked him over, bolder than the rest and not as drunk as Shitmouth.
You were afraid of him?
I wouldn't say afraid, my lord. I'd say we was leaving him for our betters. Someone like Sir.
Or you.
Me, when I had two hands. Jamie did not delude himself. Sandor would make short work of him now.
You have a name?
Rafford, if it pleases. Most call me Raff.
Raff, gather the garrison together in the Hall of 100 Hearths. Your captives as well. I'll want to see them. Those whores from the Crossroads, too. Oh, and Hote. I was distraught to hear that he had died. I'd like to look upon his head. When they brought it to him, he found that the goat's lips had been sliced off along with his ears and most of his nose. The crows had supped upon his eyes. It was still recognizably Hote, however. Jamie would have known his beard anywhere. An absurd rope of hair 2 feet long dangling from a pointed chin. Elsewise only a few leathery strips of flesh still clung to the Cahoric's skull. "Where is the rest of him?" he asked. No one wanted to tell him. Finally Shitmouth lowered his eyes and muttered,
"Rotted, sir, and et."
"One of the captives was always begging food,"
Rafford admitted.
"So sir said to give him the roast goat. The Cahoric didn't have much meat on him, though. Sir took his hands and feet first, then his arms and legs."
"The fat bugger got most, my lord,"
Shitmouth offered. "But, sir, he said to see that all the captives had a taste, and Hote, too, his own self. That horse and had slobber when we fed him, and the grease had run down into that skinny beard of his."
"Father," Jamie thought, "your dogs have both gone mad." He found himself remembering tales he had first heard as a child at Casterly Rock of mad Lady Lothston, who bathed in tubs of blood and presided over feasts of human flesh within these very walls. Somehow, revenge had lost its savour. "Take this and throw it in the lake." Jamie tossed Hote's head to Peck and turned to address the garrison. "Until such time as Lord Peter arrives to claim his seat, Sir Bonifer Hasty shall hold Harren Hall in the name of the crown. Those of you who wish may join him, if he'll have you. The rest will ride with me to Riverrun." The mountains men looked at one another.
"We're owed," said one. "Sir promised us. Rich rewards, he said."
"His very words," Shitmouth agreed. "Rich rewards for them as rides with me."
A dozen others began to yammer their assent. Sir Bonifer raised a gloved hand. Any man who remains with me shall have a hide of land to work, a second hide when he takes a wife, a third at the birth of his first child.
Land, sir, Shitmouth spat. Piss on that. If we wanted to grub in the bloody dirt, we could have bloody well stayed home. Begging your pardon, sir. Rich rewards, sir, said, meaning gold.
If you have a grievance, go to King's Landing and take it up with my sweet sister. Jamie turned to Rafford. I'll see those captors now, starting with Sir Willis Manderley.
He the fat one?
Asked Rafford. I devoutly hope so. And tell me no sad stories of how he died, or the lot of you are apt to do the same. Any hopes he might have nursed of finding Shagwell Pig or Zolo languishing in the dungeons were sadly disappointed. The brave companions had abandoned Vargo Hoat to a man, it would seem. Of Lady Hwent's people only three remained. The cook who had opened the postern gate for Sir Gregor, a bent-back armourer called Ben Blackthumb, and a girl named Pia, who was not near as pretty as she had been when Jamie saw her last. Someone had broken her nose and knocked out half her teeth. The girl fell at Jamie's feet when she saw him, sobbing and clinging to his leg with hysterical strength, till Strongbow pulled her off. "No one will hurt you now," he told her, but that only made her sob the louder. The other captives had been better treated. Sir Willis Manderley was amongst them, along with several other high-born Northmen, taken prisoner by the Mountain That Rides in the fighting at the fords of the Trident. Useful hostages, all worth a goodly ransom. They were ragged, filthy, and shaggy to a man, and some had fresh bruises, cracked teeth, and missing fingers, but their wounds had been washed and bandaged, and none of them had gone hungry. Jamie wondered if they had any inkling what they'd been eating, and decided it was better not to inquire. None had any defiance left, especially not Sir Willis, a bushy-faced tub of suet with dull eyes and sallow, sagging jowls. When Jamie told him that he would be escorted to Maidenpool and there put on a ship for White Harbour, Sir Willis collapsed into a puddle on the floor and sobbed longer and louder than Pia had. It took four men to lift him back onto his feet. Too much roast goat, Jamie reflected. Gods, but I hate this bloody castle. Harrenhal had seen more horror in its 300 years than Casterly Rock had witnessed in 3,000. Jamie commanded that fires be lit in the hall of 100 hearths and sent the cook hobbling back to the kitchens to prepare a hot meal for the men of his column. Anything but goat. He took his own supper in Hunter's Hall with Sir Bonifer Hasty, a solemn stalk of a man prone to salting his speech with appeals to the seven. "I want none of Sir Gregor's followers," he declared as he was cutting up a pear as withered as he was, so as to make certain that its non-existent juice did not stain his pristine purple doublet, embroidered with the white-bend cottest of his house. "I will not have such sinners in my service. My septon used to say all men were sinners." "He was not wrong," Sir Bonifer allowed, "but some sins are blacker than others, and fouler in the nostrils of the seven. And you have no more nose than my little brother, or my own sins would have you choking on that pear. Very well. I'll take Gregor's lot off your hands. He could always find a use for fighters. If nothing else, he could send them up the ladders first, should he need to storm the walls of Riverrun. Take the whore as well," Sir Bonifer urged. "You know the one, the girl from the dungeons. Pia." The last time he had been here, Kyburn had sent the girl to his bed, thinking that would please him. But the Pia they had brought up from the dungeons was a different creature from the sweet, simple, giggly creature who'd crawled beneath his blankets. She had made the mistake of speaking when Sir Gregor wanted quiet, so the mountain had smashed her teeth to splinters with a mailed fist and broken her pretty little nose as well. He would have done worse, no doubt, if Circe had not called him down to King's Landing to face the Red Viper's spear. Jamie would not mourn him. "Pia was born in this castle," he told Sir Bonifer. "It is the only home she has ever known." "She is a font of corruption," said Sir Bonifer. "I won't have her near my men, flaunting her parts." "I expect her flaunting days are done," he said. "But if you find her that objectionable, I'll take her." He could make her a washerwoman, he supposed. His squires did not mind raising his tent, grooming his horse, or cleaning his armor, but the task of caring for his clothes struck them as unmanly. "Can you hold Harrenhal with just your Holy 100?" Jamie asked. They should actually be called the Holy 86, having lost 14 men upon the Blackwater. But no doubt Sir Bonifa would fill up his ranks again as soon as he found some sufficiently pious recruits. "I anticipate no difficulty. The crone will light our way, and the warrior will give strength to our arms." "Or else the stranger will turn up for the whole holy lot of you." Jamie could not be certain who had convinced his sister that Sir Bonifa should be named Castellan of Harrenhal, but the appointment smelled of Orton Merryweather. Hasty had once served Merryweather's grandsire, he seemed to recall dimly, and the carrot-haired justiciar was just the sort of simple-minded fool to assume that someone called the Good was the very potion the Riverlands required to heal the wounds left by Roose Bolton, Vargo Hote, and Gregor Clegane. But he might not be wrong. Hasty hailed from the Stormlands, so had neither friends nor foes along the Trident, no blood feuds, no debts to pay, no cronies to reward. He was sober, just, and dutiful, and his Holy 86 were as well disciplined as any soldiers in the Seven Kingdoms, and made a lovely sight as they wheeled and pranced their tall grey geldings. Littlefinger had once quipped that Sir Bonifa must have gelded the riders too, so spotless was their repute. All the same, Jamie wondered about any soldiers who were better known for their lovely horses than for the foes they'd slain. They pray well, I suppose, but can they fight? They had not disgraced themselves on the Blackwater, so far as he knew, but they had not distinguished themselves either. Sir Bonifa himself had been a promising young knight in his youth, but something had happened to him, a defeat or a disgrace or a near brush with death, and afterward he had decided that jousting was an empty vanity and put away his lance for good and all. Harrenhal must be held, though, and Baelor Butthole here is the man that Circe chose to hold it. "This castle has an ill repute," he warned him, "and one that's well deserved. It's said that Harren and his sons still walk the halls by night afire. Those who look upon them burst into flame." "I fear no shade, sir. It is written in the seven-pointed star that spirits, wights, and revenants cannot harm a pious man so long as he is armored in his faith." "Then armor yourself in faith by all means, but wear a suit of mail and plate as well. Every man who holds this castle seems to come to a bad end. The mountain, the goat, even my father." "If you will forgive my saying so, they were not godly men as we are. The warrior defends us, and help is always near, if some dread foe should threaten. Maester Gullion will be remaining with his ravens. Lord Lancel is nearby at Derry with his garrison, and Lord Randall holds Maidenpool. Together we three shall hunt down and destroy whatever outlaws prowl these parts. Once that is done, the seven will guide the good folk back to their villages to plough and plant and build anew." The ones the goat didn't kill, at least. Jamie hooked his golden fingers round the stem of his wine goblet. "If any of Hote's brave companions fall into your hands, send word to me at once." The stranger might have made off with the goat before Jamie could get around to him, but Fat Zolo was still out there with Shagwell, Rorge, faithful Urswick, and the rest. "So you can torture them and kill them? I suppose you would forgive them in my place? If they made sincere repentance for their sins, yes, I would embrace them all as brothers and pray with them before I sent them to the block. Sins may be forgiven. Crimes require punishment." Hasty folded his hands before him like a steeple, in a way that reminded Jamie uncomfortably of his father. "If it is Sandor Clegane that we encounter, what would you have me do?" "Pray hard," Jamie thought, "and run. Send him to join his beloved brother and be glad the gods made seven hells. One would never be enough to hold both of the Cleganes.
He pushed himself awkwardly to his feet. Beric Dondarrion is a different matter. Should you capture him, hold him for my return. I'll want to march him back to King's Landing with a rope about his neck, and have Sir Ilyn take his head off where half the realm can see. And this Mirish priest who runs with him, it is said he spreads his false faith everywhere. Kill him, kiss him, or pray with him as you please. I have no wish to kiss the man, my lord. No doubt he'd say the same of you. Jamie's smile turned into a yawn. My pardons, I shall take my leave of you if you have no objections. None, my lord, said Hasty. No doubt he wished to pray. Jamie wished to fight. He took the steps two at a time, out to where the night air was cold and crisp. In the torchlit yard, Strongbore and Sir Flemont Brax were having at each other, whilst a ring of men-at-arms cheered them on. Sir Lyle will have the best of that one, he knew. I need to find Sir Ilyn. His fingers had the itch again. His footsteps took him away from the noise and the light. He passed beneath the covered bridge and through the flowstone yard before he realized where he was headed. As he neared the bear pit, he saw the glow of a lantern, its pale wintry light washing over the tiers of steep stone seats. Someone has come before me, it would seem. The pit would be a fine place to dance. Perhaps Sir Ilyn had anticipated him. But the knight standing over the pit was bigger, a husky bearded man in a red and white surcoat adorned with griffins. Connington? What's he doing here? Below, the carcass of the bear still sprawled upon the sands, though only bones and ragged fur remained half buried. Jamie felt a pang of pity for the beast. At least he died in battle. Sir Ronnet, he called. Have you lost your way? It is a large castle, I know. Red Ronnet raised his lantern. I wished to see where the bear danced with the maiden not so fair. His beard shone in the light as if it were a fire. Jamie could smell wine on his breath. Is it true the wench fought naked? Naked? No. He wondered how that wrinkle had been added to the story. The mummers put her in a pink silk gown and shoved a tawny sword into her hand. The goat wanted her death to be a muthing. Elsewise, the sight of Brian naked might have made the bear flee in terror, Connington laughed. Jamie did not. You speak as if you know the lady. I was betrothed to her. That took him by surprise. Brian had never mentioned a betrothal. Her father made a match for her. Thrice, said Connington. I was the second. My father's notion. I had heard the wench was ugly, and I told him so. But he said all women were the same once you blew the candle out. Your father? Jamie eyed Red Ronnet's surcoat, where two griffins faced each other on a field of red and white. Dancing griffins. Our late Hand's brother, was he? Cousin. Lord John had no brothers. No. It all came back to him. John Connington had been Prince Rhaegar's friend. When Merryweather failed so dismally to contain Robert's rebellion, and Prince Rhaegar could not be found, Ares had turned to the next best thing and raised Connington to the handship. But the Mad King was always chopping off his hands. He had chopped Lord John after the Battle of the Bells, stripping him of honors, lands, and wealth, and packing him off across the sea to die in exile, where he soon drank himself to death. The cousin, though, Red Ronnet's father, had joined the rebellion and been rewarded with Griffin's Roost after the Trident. He only got the castle, though. Robert kept the Gaul and bestowed the greater part of the Connington lands on more fervent supporters. Sir Ronnet was a landed knight, no more. For any such, the Maid of Tarth would have been a sweet plum indeed. How is it that you did not wed? Jamie asked him. Why, I went to Tarth and saw her. I had 6 years on her, yet the wench could look me in the eye. She was a sow in silk, though most sows have bigger teats. When she tried to talk, she almost choked on her own tongue. I gave her a rose and told her it was all that she would ever have from me. Connington glanced into the pit. The bear was less hairy than that freak.
Jamie's golden hand cracked him across the mouth so hard the other knight went stumbling down the steps. His lantern fell and smashed, and the oil spread out burning. You are speaking of a high-born lady, sir. Call her by her name. Call her Brain. Connington edged away from the spreading flames on his hands and